We start.
That's our theme song, isn't it?
I love it.
How's it going, Katie?
It's good, Patrick.
Did you have a good week?
Yes, I did. I had an excellent week. It was kind of a wind-down week for me. It wasn't as busy as I have been, and I attended to many things that needed to be taken care of.
We had our first, quote-unquote, board meeting for HRN, Heritage Radio Network.
That was very exciting.
I think it's the youngest board ever.
Yeah, I didn't realize we were even calling it a board. I thought it was more like sort of the core team.
An advisory board.
Yeah, very, yeah, young but smart.
I know, young but smart.
That's what counts.
Dedicated.
And full of ideas.
We're like, I'm sorry, we can't hire you. You're not a nerd enough.
Are you saying I'm a nerd, Patrick?
We're all nerds. So I'm excited about today's show. We're going to talk about curing, and we have three different cultures represented. We have, I mean, all curing in America, but one's an Italian, one's Filipino, and one, I guess, is also Italian, but he's servicing the
Italian,
Berkeley.
Italian, but also I got the feeling when I looked at the website that it was also some German-style curing and sausage making and so on. But, you know, I think we've jumped ahead a little bit. Don't we need to say that this is the main course.
The main course.
On Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by Esposito's.
Esposito sausage, which has been around since the 1920s.
God bless them.
They're really, really good. But they, they're big supporters. They buy all our trim. They buy all the trim from Heritage Foods.
That's a beautiful thing.
I know,
there's a lot of trim when there's.
We generate about 3,000 pounds a week. So,
Patrick, where do you process all your stuff? Where does it all get?
Out of Paradise Locker Meats is about 90%, know, and then we have another.
And where are they located?
Right outside of Kansas City, which is perfect location because it's like right in the middle of everything.
Because it's in the middle of the
country, yeah. And then we have a processor upstate, Dan Purdy. He's near Utica, and he does, you know, every 2 to 3 weeks, we process 10 to 15 pigs with him. And, you know, we sell by the case. I was realizing, like, that's one of the Heritage's big achievements, is that we sell local quality proteins, but by the case.
That's
you don't have
thing.
To buy the pig, you know. And actually, it's funny that you bring that up, because it's like, you know, how do you get things done? And you sent me this really interesting press release from the Farmland Trust, American Farmland Trust. And I've always thought, like, the best way to help farmers is buy their land. Give it to them, you know, like keep it forever from being developed. And actually really interesting, you know, with these two big food movies now, I saw this guy on CNN, they're getting all this play, and the American Farmland Trust brought up this really good thing, a point. She says, both films fall short in addressing the key issues of farmland capacity and local food infrastructure needed to support new kinds of food systems. So, you know, I love all these good things, but, you know, I hope that, you know, Michael Pollan, Eric Saucer, the directors, Hollywood, all the people that, like, put energy behind this movie understand, like, concrete economic change for farmers needs to be the outcome of this education.
I don't think they do, actually. We saw Food Inc. last night, and I thought there were some really good points about the movie. And of course, I think everybody needs to recognize, some of the more egregious aspects of industrialized food. But at the same time, it did not address the infrastructure of things like, well, if you only have four packers who are packing all the meat, then, guys who want to do the right thing, where are they going to go with their product and how are we going to help them get it there? And the other thing that it didn't address at all, I felt, was the economic impact of buying locally at this point, because of the lack of infrastructure, costs a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And it remains the province of the educated and the relatively well-to-do. And I think that, until there's a more of a democratic process in the sort of food revolution, that it's going to remain the province of the well-to-do, and it's never going to be trickling down.
Absolutely. And, you know, the same press release is like, oh, no one really knows what percentage of food, like in San Francisco, is local or in New York City. And I think that that's a you know, they should pony up and admit, I bet, I would put money that it's less than 1%.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.
You know, so it's like,
certainly less than 5. It has to be.
Certainly, with if you consider meats, and yeah. you just look at meats, I bet it's like 0.1 of 1%. It
yeah.
just doesn't, you know, think about all the deli meats at the bodegas and all that. Like,
yeah.
it's such an uphill battle. And, you know, I just hope that some of these intellectual people, you know, that are talking about trickle down actually do, you know, what I did or what other people do across the country, which is get into a van, sell the stuff, move it around, you know, help these people, you know, through real mundane, simple
things. Is
that
how you got started at Heritage Foods?
Yeah, I made all, I violated every HACCP plan ever written by delivering fresh pork in an unrefrigerated U-Haul. Yeah! And no one came around, actually, and then for a year I was doing that every Tuesday at 6 a.m. And then finally, Sarah Obradis, who is a co-founder of the wholesale business, she was like, I'll come deliver with you. She was like putting whole hams on her shoulders.
Good for her.
Opened up, 70, 80 restaurant accounts here in New York. And then we were lucky to meet Pat LaFrieda, who was like, Joe Bastianich actually introduced us and was like, you need help. You've gotten big enough, you know, that you now have a real business. So they let us now run our pork business through their, you know, trucking and all that. So
that's great.
Well, I'm really excited to get Amy and Romy on, and we're going to talk kimchi. We're going to talk curing. We're going to talk about their new restaurant, Purple Yam. And they're two of my favorite, like, nicest people in the food world.
Fantastic. They are, in case for those of you who aren't familiar with Amy and Romy, they owned the wonderful Filipino, only true Filipino restaurant in New York City, Cendrillon.
It really was the only true.
So it's a real privilege and pleasure to have them on and to talk about their new venture, which is opening up, in the next month or so, I think,
Purple
according
Yam
to their website.
Very exciting. So, we'll be right back on the main course. And here we are back on the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer. And we are sponsored today by Esposito Sausages. God bless their souls.
They're so awesome.
And today we have with us Amy Bessa and Romy Doratan, who are formerly of Cendrillon and about to open up a new venture in Brooklyn called The Purple Yam.
Yeah.
Hi.
We down with that. So thank you so much for coming out to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, we're excited. So we wanted to talk about curing today because curing, I guess, is a big deal in Filipino cuisine. correct me if I'm wrong.
And tell us, before we even get into curing, what is Filipino cuisine? Like, how does it differentiate itself from, you know, other Asian cuisines and from other world cuisines, just so we can put it in the context?
Well, you know, the traditional way of describing a cuisine is listing the most famous or the most, cooked dishes that Filipinos cook, right? Mm-hmm. And the three main dishes that Filipinos do are adobo, sinigang, and kinilaw. Adobo is a vinegar-based stew. Uh-huh. And sinigang is a sour soup made with sour fruits. And kinilaw is like a ceviche. So you can sour that with either vinegar or citrus or, you know, anything, or sour fruits again. And if you notice that, the main flavor that goes through is sour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're all a lot of soups then, a lot of liquidy based stews, correct?
Yes, that's why we eat with spoon and fork.
Mm, no knife. No. Interesting.
And why is that, though? I mean, that is sort of interesting that it's really... And you don't do a lot of really hot, spicy foods, I don't think, right?
Well, you know, the Philippines is an archipelago.
Yes.
And it's like 7,100 islands. And the first Filipinos that settled on the shores were, of course, on the coast.
Uh-huh.
So the food that people developed was... the first foods they ate were seafood.
Mm-hmm. And
sorry, I'll stop doing all that. That's the last one for a while.
It's a boy thing.
Okay. I'm sorry, but that's how people ate, you know? Like, of course there was wild boar and wild deer, wild chicken. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very surprised to see wild chicken.
Well, didn't the chicken originate? I know that they trace the chicken to a single common ancestor. And I don't know if it was in the Philippines or what. It's on our heritage calendar. But anyway, either way, it's fish that was...
seafood, like a lot of shellfish, like oysters.
Abalone, clams, I would think, right? No?
Urchin?
You know, abalone was like a Chinese thing.
Oh.
Yes. And I think it was found... more out towards the ocean and like very far-flung islands. And it became a very big industry mm-hmm. that the Chinese did with the inhabitants of that area.
And what's the history of the Philippines? Like, when do you trace your guys' history back? Like, when were written records? Like, is it a kingdom? Is it a president? I mean, how?
Well,
tell us
you know,
about.
We were part of the Majapahit Empire, you know. And so the first... I would say the first influences of the Philippines came from India. You know, we were Hinduized before anything else. Hmm. And if you study our language,
which is
at least Tagalog, well, there are like over 100
dialects, right?
Yeah. Well, I consider them languages.
Okay.
Because they're very different. At least for several languages that I know. There are a lot of Sanskrit words.
Mm-hmm.
And the word for vinegar, which is suka, you know, the Sanskrit term is achoka. So you know that's Sanskrit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, of course, there were people from Indonesia that came. There was also slave trade coming on. They used to raid our shores for slaves and bring them to Sumatra, you know, near the Spice Islands. And so after the Hinduization of the Philippines came the Muslim influence. But from what I've read, that was only limited to the ruling class. You know, and the Maharlika or the royalty of these little fiefdoms, they were Muslim. But then beyond that, below that, of course, there were slaves too and very poor people. They were basically pagan, you know, like or animists.
Mm-hmm.
And so And then, of course, the Chinese came. First the Arab traders came, and then the Chinese came, and then Spain arrived, like in the 1500s, and because of the Spanish colonization, we went through like 250 years of the galleon trade with Mexico, Manila, Acapulco, and a lot of food exchange happened there.
Right.
So, you know, everything that, you know, potatoes, chilies, tomatoes, avocado, all of those came from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, we sent like mangoes, tamarind, coconut, you know, a few things.
It's what happens when you're an archipelago, right? Like, many people pass through, you know, when you're not a landlocked, like, you know, the United States is hard to penetrate, but like Sicily or these things, very fascinating food
exchanges. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
well, trade, we have a couple more minutes for this introduction part. So let's jump to the late 1960s or whenever, you know, you guys were born and when you guys met.
I like the fact that you make us younger.
So tell me, like, when did you guys meet? When did you guys decide you were going to become restaurateurs here in New York? Romy, give us a little bit of the history of you and Amy's empire here.
Yeah. We met in Philadelphia in the 70s. We were both students at Temple University there. And we were also activists at that time against the Marcos dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And then for some reason I got involved in cooking. Oh no, I ran out of money, so I got a dishwashing job.
That's excellent, Roman.
Yeah. And then one day the chef left and he took all his cooks and staff to another restaurant. So the owner asked me to if I wanted to cook. And I said, okay. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea about cooking at all.
None. So you're not one of those guys that like grew up at grandma's knee watching her prepare the adobo.
No.
You know? I mean, isn't that what every no, but like every cook, when you talk, scratch any cook, and I swear it's a grandmother story. It's amazing how universal that experience is.
Mm-hmm.
But now, how many grandmothers will do that for their children, right?
I don't know. I'm not a grandmother yet, but yeah, I hope I will. Oh.
So we have 30 seconds left, and then we'll come talk about curing. So Cendrillon opened what year?
1995.
95. Ooh. What a beautiful restaurant that was. Like, what a cultural loss for Soho to lose one of the last family-run independent restaurants. But good news is Purple Yam is now opening, and where is that going to be?
On Cortelyou Road in Ditmas Park in Brooklyn.
Oh, fantastic. And it's going to be much the same cuisine and staff and everything that we have come to love.
Yes. Very personal.
Awesome.
How many seats? It'll be smaller than Cendrillon, I'm guessing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think inside it'll be like, including the bar, would be around 40.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's
we have
very
a little backyard
cute,
that could seat about 16 people.
Sweet. Sounds great.
It would be great.
All right. Well, we will come back and then we'll get into our main theme. You know, Katie was actually worked as a butcher and I'm in the meat business. So you guys are chefs. So it'll be fun to talk about curing when we come back.
Thank you.
Here we are back on the main course.
I'm Patrick Martins. And I'm Katie Kiefer. We're with Amy Besa and Romy Doratan from The Purple Yam, a soon-to-be-opened restaurant in Brooklyn. And they will be one of the few, if not, again, one of the only pure Filipino cuisine restaurants in the city, or certainly in the five boroughs.
Is that true?
Well, there are other restaurants called Turu Turu, which are like little steam top table type restaurants, and you Turu Turu means point point. So you go,
you point out what you want.
Yes,
and then the cook.
That's really like home cooking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you know, I don't know. I would shy away from pure.
Okay.
You know, we like to serve some traditional classic dishes that we interpret as our own, which cool. means using Patrick's meats.
Thank you.
Let's have a round of applause for that one, Patrick. Come on.
Maybe we'll just do this one.
Okay. Yeah.
So now tell us, when it comes to curing, what is the curing tradition in the Philippines? I mean, what do you guys cure? And what animals?
Well, in terms of animals, you know, basically wild animals before you make, Amy was talking about tapa, which are basically air-dried from the deer or from wild boar. And
is pork in general a big part of Filipino cuisine? I always think of it as a poultry-based cuisine more than a pig-based cuisine, but
no,
that's...
It's more...
Well, wild boar demonstrate is almost my ignorance. Extinct. And yeah.
Not
and
in our country. Oh my God, feral pigs. We have way too many of them.
No. You know where they are still alive is down south because it's Muslim country.
Ah.
They don't get
so
hunted.
They don't eat pig. Yeah, of course.
But I grew up with wild boar.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely fabulous. But you can't find that in, you know, that part of the country where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So did they substitute... you know, farmed pigs to make up for that? And
of course.
You have all, I mean, it's a big, so you would say that pork is the main meat consumed?
Yes.
In the Philippines, wow.
Yes. Very pork-based.
Mm-hmm. And that's for all the archipelago? I mean, is that all the islands still unite with common recipes and cuisines?
Yes, pork is very, very much loved. If you remove pork from... the Philippines, you would have a revolution. And I think because the two main influences of our cooking are the Chinese and the Spanish. Mm-hmm. And both are very, very much pork-based.
That's so true.
Cultures, you know. Yeah. And Spain, as you know, promoted pork to get rid of the Muslims and the Jews.
So right now
I
we
did
have,
not know that.
Oh, well, that the Spanish that was the Spanish Inquisition. That was what it was all about.
You know, I actually read a lot about the Spanish Inquisition. I never heard anyone advance the theory.
Did you get it from Monty Python? The Inquisition. That was Mel Brooks.
That was a good sound effect.
So what about how do you differentiate the burro and the tocino?
Okay, because there's like the traditional ways of airing, drying, salting, and sugar. Because we have the tapa and the tocino.
Mm-hmm.
The tapa is usually with beef.
Okay, and that's the air-dried.
Yes, but that has a little bit of salt too. But it's really air, it's like jerky.
So this is one jerky. Of the four curing methods then, is...
And how would that incorporate into your cuisine? I mean, do you guys then like reconstitute it like a bacalao or something? Or do you eat it sliced very thin like prosciutto or,
The tapa, they cure it in pieces already. Uh-huh. And then it's usually sun-dried on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's hung, from what my grandmother did, she would pound it and then she would air dry it and then... grill it first
without putting salt or sugar first.
I think it's salt and lime juice. We have a Philippine lime called calamansi. And maybe a little bit of sugar.
Huh. So that's the...
And then, so it gets marinated in that, and then, it gets grilled. Oh, I see.
Oh, my God. There's Mark, who one of the ways we know each other. But anyway, that's another show.
Okay. And then
when you serve it, what's the preparation?
Then we fry it.
Wow. So it's not really dried out? Like, I mean... It's,
you know, the most incredible thing in my memory is the tapang usa, mm-hmm. which is... wild deer. And when it's deep fried, it crumbles. It's crispy, crunchy.
Wow.
Brittle.
Yeah, and it's fried, and you put it on rice and an egg, and you put a little bit of vinegar and cut tomatoes. It is just the most amazing breakfast. And if you talk to any of my brothers... That is the one memory they have, which we can't get anymore.
Right. Mm. Because that sounds very Korean to me, actually, right? We have a native Korean here. Hae-jin is a kimchi expert, and she's been... Well,
I do make kimchi with romi, by the way.
But she... But don't you think that sounds very Korean with the rice, the egg, the crumbly meat?
Crumbly meat.
Yeah, no, am I making that up? I feel like I've sort of had that.
Maybe bulgogi, the Korean barbecue dish with the rice.
Yeah.
It's not really crumbly, but like, yeah, the combination.
And then the egg is mixed in, right, and right. Yeah, that sounds delicious.
And now tell us, you were just here at the Roberta's on our roof of our shipping containers, and you were wondering if more cabbage could be grown for kimchi. Yeah. So is that a specialty of yours? That's a kind of preservation technique as well, right?
Yeah, that's a vinegary mm-hmm. preservation. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about some, you know, the process of kimchi.
Kimchi, so it's a pickled with the salt and a little bit of sugar and a starch. So it ferments and mm-hmm. then it preserves. So it's...
What do you mean by starch? You mean
starch? I would put, like, I don't think many people, and not all Koreans do, but like my mother's recipe was you make a little bit of a starch mix,
like a corn starch mix,
like a flour starch or rice.
Oh,
yeah,
rice flour
starch.
Huh?
Yeah, mixed with the pepper powder.
Right, because kimchi is very spicy.
It's really spicy, but you don't have to make it all spicy.
Yeah,
that's
but
what
why
I'm trying
you
to
want
come up
to?
With Rumi, I love spicy.
Rumi
too.
And Amy wanted to make a kimchi not too spicy, not too strong, with the fish sauce. So uh-huh. that's what we've been experimenting.
Uh huh.
Interesting. Yeah. And the kimchi is how long is the process? I mean, it's from picking on the roof garden to actually consumption. Like, how long do you have to marinate it in its vinegar.
There is no vinegar.
Oh,
actually.
Not vinegar.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, because of its a sour taste, a lot of people ask it has a vinegar mm-hmm. on it, but like it's like
but it's actually fermented.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So you can make a fresh kimchi, which will take maybe 2 hours, so you mm-hmm. can eat it right away, and from then on it will ferment. So my favorite is like a third day. You ferment it 3 days outside, and then you put it in the refrigerator, mm-hmm. and that's my favorite time to eat. But some people like it like a month old, year
that's
old.
That's interesting, yeah. What are the health regulations on that? I would want that. I mean, like, I want 2 years, like a wine.
No, really, we can really have that kind. You can taste that kind of old kimchi in Korea. Hmm. They will say in the restaurant, we have a three-year-old kimchi.
Wow. Yeah. Do you like it?
I do like it because it's so rustic, it almost becomes different food. Mm-hmm. But it's not disgusting as it sounds like. It is just really, yeah.
And let me ask, does the raw ingredients, are they as important in a kimchi as they would be in a salad where you don't do anything to it and you just put a little oil and vinegar? I mean, is the pristineness of the ingredients as important with kimchi as it would be with any other recipe?
I think every food material is most important. I think... like, we experimented using Japanese daikon instead of using Korean radish. And Korean radishes has so much water, so it does make different taste of kimchi. Hmm. And also, you want to have really fresh cabbage and radish, and good quality of salt is very important, and pepper powder also.
Yeah, very interesting.
Sea salt, yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with one more segment with you guys. But then we hope you stay on because our other guests, Taylor and Chizit, are calling in. So it might be nice to if you guys can stick around. So we'll be right back in 30 seconds. Okay.
This is Katie Kiefer with Patrick Martins on Heritage Radio Network's The Main Course, sponsored by Esposito Sausages. And we're talking curing today. We have Amy and Romy from The Purple Yam. And we were just exploring the varying kinds of curing and cured products in Filipino cuisine. So let's pick it up again back in the away from kimchi and back to Filipino curing and talk a little bit more about, besides the beef that we talked about or the wild deer that we talked about being air dried and then crumbly up, you know, in a deep fried kind of way. What else do you guys cure? Do you cure pork products like prosciutto? Do you make things like hams? Do you, you know, we have so many
pig's heads.
Yeah, we have so many cured products that come out of the pork, and then also there's cured fish of many different types, and that's something else I'd like to just touch on quickly.
The most famous pork cured one is, we call it tocino. It's basically cured in salt, sugar, and achuete, and garlic.
What is achuete?
Achuete is the anato seed.
Achuete. Oh, I always think it's achuete.
We call it achuete in Filipino.
Right. But it's that's the thing that turns things yellow.
Or
right?
reddish.
Yeah, like a reddishy yellow. Yeah.
But the more traditional way of doing that is called burro.
Oh, burro is the difference.
Because that, it requires fermentation. And the burro, that actually is almost the origins of sushi.
Uh-huh.
You know how fish was preserved in Thailand and then it moved to Japan? They generally put salt and a little bit of sugar maybe in rice and it ferments.
Yeah.
And then they wrap the fish in that and then that's and in seaweed and then they can preserve it. So you can you have food for a week or something or
right,
2 weeks.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But in and it's amazing to find this in a particular region in the Philippines in central Luzon where the practice of burro which means fermentation is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And the principle is mushy rice. Watery rice with a little bit of salt. And that ferments. And fermentation requires starch.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as Heijin was saying just
yes,
a minute ago. Yeah.
It that's where the bacteria
starts happening. Yeah.
They feed on that.
Uh-huh.
And so put the pork, you know, you use a pork belly cut that's got a good cross section of the skin, the fat, the meat, and the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And bone then, and belly with the spare rib section attached.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you submerge that in that rice mixture.
Wow. Who knew? I never thought of curing something with
rice. You know, not many
rice.
Filipinos know this. It's only a particular region, and it's something because it becomes very stinky.
Uh-huh.
And
can't scare me.
And it's really an acquired taste. That, because some people eat the rice afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a little scary.
But they fry it, you know. But the pork is just amazing.
So what happens? It becomes very soft and...
It becomes vinegary. It's sour.
It's sour.
It sours the pork. And then, of course, you cook the pork.
Yeah.
What I like to do with that is I boil it in water to render the fat, and then you fry it and you put some sugar, uh-huh. and it caramelizes. So it's fantastic. So it's salty, sweet, and sour.
Are we going to eat this at the Purple Yam?
I don't know if we can do it.
Really?
Because it's very tricky.
Wah, wah, wah.
It's very, very
sounds
tricky.
Sounds so good.
We have tocino, which is the more simple uh-huh. one, which we cure the pork with salt, sugar, and the achuete.
Right.
But to try and ferment it and make it sour is very tricky.
I would imagine, because you don't want to poison your guests.
No,
exactly.
That'd be
bad. Yes.
Poisoning your family. No,
and if you talk to,
I don't see how fermenting, I mean, it seems to me that when you ferment something, you're kind of killing a lot of the bacteria just through the action of fermentation.
Well, you get,
we
you
eat
have
so many fermented products already.
You need the right bacteria.
Yeah, but I mean, there's so many things. I mean, beer is a fermented beverage, hard cider, you know, there's so many different things that are already fermented, and that's what gives them their flavor and their texture quality. So
all in an effort to preserve food
yeah.
through the winter, right? I mean, that's where so much of this starts, is surviving the long winter. Although
exactly.
I don't know if you guys had long winters in the Philippines.
Well, it actually goes way back to where we just started cooking, and people were able to, you know, gather in groups because they had learned how to control fire. I'm like all excited about this book I just read.
Wait,
it's so great.
Diamond?
No, it's called Catching Fire by Richard Wrangham, who is actually an anthropologist and biologist from Harvard University, and he wrote a book about, very short little book about why Homo erectus became Homo erectus and then Homo sapiens, and it was really all because
of the food
they learned how to cook. Ooh. And that allowed our brains to develop.
Yeah, because you got more nutrition. One
yeah,
of my favorite
and more
movies.
Easily digested. I mean, it was so interesting. And it talked a lot about preserving foods.
Yeah. One of my
very
favorite movies of all time
that you're describing
was about that guy. What's his name? He was just recently in a movie. He's a great gestural actor. And anyway, it was about a clan that had captured fire.
Yes.
But all they could do was keep it. They didn't know how to recreate it. So eventually went out one day. And so he was sent off to try to find it. Yeah, and there was this tribe that taught him with this girl.
In terms of preservation, because we have typhoons, rainy season also. So you need to have dried fish.
I see,
yes. Just preserve.
Exactly.
Exactly. And then if there's a big abundance of harvest, for example, mm-hmm. fish, and you cannot consume that the same day, you have to.
Have to, yeah, exactly. Food stocks.
Food preserve it.
The two key things in our cooking are fermented things, which is the bagoong and the patis, which is fish sauce, mm-hmm. which is a byproduct of, fermented fish, which
right.
is similar to trasi and balachang. You know, Southeast Asia.
They all have some variation on the fish sauce. Is
yes.
that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just like the ancient Romans did with garum.
That exactly. Yeah. That's what bagoong is. It's
mm-hmm.
garum.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And and fish sauce is a byproduct of that. You know, you layer very fresh fish in jars and with salt and fish, and you loosely cover it, put it in a cool area of the house, and let it ferment. Hmm. And the liquid that rises up to the top is the fish sauce.
Right. And that's why
very
it's so
interesting.
Salty.
Well, we are going to take a break. Hopefully you guys will stay. And we're going to have Cesare Caselle talk about the Italian curing tradition. And maybe we could make some cross comparisons on what's the same and what's different across
right.
cultures.
Okay.
Thank you.
Here we back. We're back on The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer, and we are Heritage Radio Network, and this week we are sponsored by Esposito's Sausages.
Good memory. I always forget to mention the sponsors.
Today we have, well, we've been talking with Amy and Romy from the Purple Yam, soon to be, and we're about to pick up with Cesare Casella.
One of the nicest guys in the industry.
And one of the best.
Cures.
Absolutely.
Cesare, are you with us? Cesare.
Signore.
Cesare.
No está. No. Wait. No.
Oh, my God.
Wrong language.
we the Heritage Radio Network is aspiring to increase its 30% success rate on the phone lines.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a minute about Cesare, because while the boys are trying to get him on the line, he is the proprietor of Salumeria Rossi, which opened up on the Upper West Side just about 6 or 8 months ago, maybe, I think. Mm-hmm. Not quite a year. And I noticed it right away. I admit I have not yet been in there, although I've definitely checked out the products in there.
Cesare, really, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, ciao, Cesare.
Ciao.
Dove sei?
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno, come vai?
Where are we calling you? Are you in Colorado?
Yes, in Aspen.
Wow, what are you doing there?
It's at the Food and Wine Festival.
What are you doing there? Do you have a stand? Or are you getting an award?
I have a stand and I slice prosciutto.
Is this prosciutto that you are making your very own self? And is this part of your Salumeria Rossi? Or is this like a whole separate enterprise of yours?
No, it's the same.
It's the same.
It's a prosciutto di Parma, and plus we have the porchetta and the other type di salumi.
Mm-hmm. So now, Cesare, just a brief history. We have about 8 minutes to talk. Your parents owned one of the most famous osteria in Tuscany, correct?
Yes. Now, I grew up in this place. There was a simple osteria. And then slowly I went involved in the restaurant. And we have a store there, plus restaurant. And
what's it called?
Vipore.
Vipore.
And then in 1992, I started to come into New York. And since then, I started to spend time in New York and some time in Italy.
And then you came and you opened Beppe, right? Was your first...
Yes, before I was a Coco Pazzo, and I opened Beppe.
All right.
And then after
Maremma,
and now Salumeria Rossi.
Which is a real new, almost concept for how people eat here in America and in New York. It's a true Salumeria where you can taste from many different cured meats, correct?
Yes, it's a Salumeria is a traditional story in Italy, especially in a small village where you going to buy the salumi. A grocery. Plus, I had the part of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. But it's a very small, and then it's a more in concept. It's a Italian tapas, for to be simple.
Very interesting. And then we'll talk about this next time you're on, but we don't really have enough time to cover it today. But Cesare has done a lot to increase the diversity of food here in America with beans, but also he started a pig program with Thanksgiving Farm in upstate New York, where the Stonewall pig is now one of the types of pigs that he cures. But tell us, Cesare, what types of foods are you curing? And tell us a little bit, if you could, about what is the Italian style of curing?
Curing in Italy is a very, the things more important, so like prosciutto. In the end, is only salt, good pigs, and the air, the esperance, that you don't need nothing else. Is a more important... In Italy, when you cure product, it's in the end to preserve for the winter time. Traditionally, you raise the pigs until the winter time, and then when you arrive in the beginning of the winter, you preserve the pigs for the winter time. So the way simple is salt. Salt. Only few areas in Italy, in the south, in the northeast Italy, they use the smoke. mm-hmm. but rest of the Italy they use only salt.
So there's no fermenting, and we were just talking to Amy and Romy from Cendrillon or the Purple Yam about Filipino tradition in curing, and they use a lot of they ferment a lot of products.
Okay, salami,
which is quite
salami
different
you need
from what you do.
No, it's salami. You need the fermentation. You need to have the fermentation because is the way they give a flavor. When you have a product, they are ground.
Uh huh.
So when these are the big pieces like pancetta, prosciutto, they have only salt or in dry or in salamoia. Salamoia is a brine.
Uh-huh.
For example, for speck or capocollo, cioè coppa, they use a brine.
Uh-huh.
And besides the process, what is the greatest challenge for you now that you have a line of cured meats for Salumeria and that's expanding? What is the greatest challenge to do here in the States, you know, that different from Italy?
What is the big challenge is the difference that I find it's especially for the materia prima, try for the pigs.
Mm-hmm.
It's the quality. The pigs that you find, but especially because in this country it's difficult to find old pigs. They are maximum 6 months. They are 240 pounds. In Italy, normally, for the consortio, they use pigs that are 350 pounds.
Hmm.
For different reason, one because 6 months the pigs they have not so much fat. In Italy, fat is important, but especially because of the fat, when they have 6 months or 9 months or 12 months, they change the difference, the consistency of the fat.
Hmm.
So practically, they are not enough fat when you especially make salami, but at the same time, the meat, it's different because when the pigs, they are more old, there, the flavors are more strong.
Very, very interesting. And tell us about some of the things that we would see if we came to Salumeria Rossi. You know, what would you recommend that people try? I mean, what are you most happy with your initial curing program?
But I think that it's important. It's important that what are we doing? Try to make a new. I believe that, like that we started this program, I work with you to find the right meat, because when you eat the pigs, you eat the pork or you cure pork, they're not the same. So it's possible for you to have a great quality pork meat for eat, but maybe they are not good for curing, mm-hmm. because they have a different consistency. I talk about, for example, very good, when I was in Italy, I used to raise pigs too. And when I use the pigs for the restaurant, the pigs I use to eat everything, try what is left over from the restaurant, every food, but that pig is not was good for curing because they take it when you going to cure. They don't take the salt like you have a pig only. The pig they have you ground you raise with grass or cereali.
Mm-hmm. Well,
in Salumeria, what I try to do to have different type of the pigs when they are cooked. For example, is it possible? No, I make these spare ribs. They are cooked with in a sauce, but it's like a Toscan style. They look like a la cacciatora because they have a tomato, they have a spice. And they are very interesting.
Mm.
And I make a sauce for pasta with the, I think they are the Berkshire or I don't know what you send it to me.
It was really commodity pork that we just pretended was heritage. No, non è vero. Non è vero. It was probably Berkshire. Very, very interesting. Well, Cesare, I'm a big fan of yours, and I hope that when you can come back to the studio often and come actually visit and be here, and we could do more with you. But thank you so much for being
part of
this curing theme. And it's Salume di Rossi, everybody. It's on 73rd and Amsterdam.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes, thank you.
Travel safe, Cesare.
Ciao.
We'll see
you
soon.
Ci vediamo. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
You know, one of the things I noticed about me.
Here I am blabbing on about the French tradition of curing. This is Katie Kiefer.
She's like, let me get this in the next sentence. The French tradition of curing. We're the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
Yes, and I'm Katie Kiefer. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and today we're sponsored by
Esposito Sausage.
Thanks,
buys a ton
Patrick.
Of trim a week.
That's right.
So we have had very interesting guests so far. We've covered the Filipino curing tradition. We've just touched upon it, really. You
really?
Guys have to come back.
Just touched.
Cesare basically got just a couple minutes. He could have gone on for weeks as well, talking about the Italian style. And now we have one of the great curers in America, Taylor Boddicker from the Fatty Calf in Napa. Hey, Taylor.
Hello, hello. How y'all doing?
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How about you?
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Let's hear all about your curing program. What are you guys doing out there?
Basically, we're curing little bits of lots of different types of things, mostly pork. We have a small prosciutto program going. We do about a dozen different kinds of salami. We get jowls in to make guanciale. We do brisaola, which is like an Italian-style cured beef I've round. We do, cured pork loin, cured pork belly for pancetta, all kinds of stuff.
Do you smoke also?
We do.
You
do a lot
of smoking.
We make eggs. We do. We do a couple smoked salamis, like a salami cotto. We also do hams, bacon, andouille, linguiça.
Yeah.
See, what else we throw in the smoker? We do ham hocks. We kind of.
Chorizo.
I mean,
so you,
we do
you kind of cover all the bases
yeah.
there. Yeah.
A bit, for sure.
How many products do you actually include in your line, like that you know you produce consistently?
Well, on the whole menu, there's probably about 120.
Wow.
I'd say about 45 or 50 of which we have on hand all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and we kind of rotate different specials in and out depending on seasonality and holidays and you know fun stuff
sure.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And now we were talking about, you know, the curing traditions, in the Philippines. And now what
cool.
is yours more an Italian style or do you kind of span the spectrum?
I'd say it's pretty much like more of a Western European style kind of thing. We do some French inspired stuff, some Italian, a little bit of Spanish. You know, we do like one of those lomo embuchados with the paprika on the outside. It's cured pork loin. It's kind of like lonza, but it's skinless. And, you know, it's got some of the similar seasonings on the outside as chorizo, or chorizo, as I say. Mostly Italian, probably 60 Italian, 35 French, and then 5% a few other nationalities.
Miscellaneous,
mm-hmm. yeah.
yeah.
What do you think are the biggest challenges in curing programs? I mean, actually, I have three questions for you. First is... how much has the whole sort of cured meats thing taken off in the last few years? Because all of a sudden, I'm seeing a lot of it now.
Oh, it's gotten huge.
Huge,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely huge.
I thought I was not mistaken in that.
So, no, it's definitely gotten a lot more popular.
Why do you think that is? I mean, what do you think is that being driven by chefs who want to use more of the animal, or is the consumer demand higher, or is it sort of a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both, and I think it's a happy situation where one kind of feeds the other. First of all, consumers have seen what a huge difference it makes when people use good raw products. You know, pork from Heritage Foods USA, doing small batches. And no,
thank you,
Taylor. I mean, it's easy for me to plug because you know we've been using it. You there?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
We're doing sound effects here.
It's easy to plug it because we've been using it for years, and it makes an awesome product. But like I said, using good raw ingredients and making small batches and not jacking it full of starter culture and Bactoferm and things like that, you wind up with something that is unique to your own restaurant and place. And I mean, you're dealing with nature, so sometimes things don't work out the way you want, even if you follow all the steps exactly right.
Right.
I think it's kind of like having your own wine or cheese program. You know, you've got something that's completely typical of your place that's going to taste different made in your kitchen than it would anywhere else, even if somebody uses the same recipe. Sorry, go ahead.
No, just to follow up on her question, Katie's question, why did it take so long? What kept that revolution from happening, in the 70s?
I think part of it is that, for a long time it was just too easy to get the really highly processed stuff, and that was always available, and also maybe having something to do with a lot of the regulations. I know that in New York State right now, a lot of chefs are having problems with health departments about running a curing program, even though these are things that have been being made for, thousands of years. excuse me. So I think I think part of it is, it's a backlash against the industrialized system that we're really just kind of seeing right now. That's pretty much all I could figure. I've been doing charcuterie professionally for about 11 years or so, and it's really exploded over the last 4 or 5, which is, great for us, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I've gotten a lot more contemporaries now to bounce ideas off of. I mean, I keep in touch with a lot of the other curers out here in the Bay Area.
So there are a lot of people who are running curing programs for their restaurants,
or for
like Whole Foods Market type places, or farmers markets.
Well, that's kind of a tricky one because to keep something going for just your restaurant is pretty easy, but to keep something handmade and artisanal and still be able to supply someplace like Whole Foods or something like that, it's a different beast altogether. And a lot of times the costs are so great that to get the average consumer to be able to try it and understand that it costs a lot more money, to get that kind of product to market is a bit more of a challenge.
That's always my big question in terms of what we, sort of style the food revolution now. And I'm always curious, to me, that economic piece of the puzzle is the one piece that doesn't really seem to translate to sort of the broad mainstream consumer base. And how can we overcome that? Like, how can we make it cheaper? Like, what do you see as the future of your business, for instance, at the Fatted Calf? I mean, you've reached probably, the maximum audience that you're going to reach in your area. I don't know if you do a big mail order business. Maybe you do, but...
He will.
What?
we absolutely have reached critical mass in our own facility, which we only moved into about a year and a half ago.
Where is it? Tell people where it is, Taylor.
We're in Napa, California, at the Oxbow Public Market, right off First Street, and it's right in downtown Napa, right on the river.
Cool.
It's a great little market. There's a good fish market, produce, spices, killer cheese and wine shop. It's a cool, little public market, which we always wanted to be a part of.
How many pounds of product do you move every week, would you say?
I'd say we produce, since a lot of it is going up for months and months and months, get about 2,000 pounds a week, Patrick?
Yeah, I was like, they buy a ton of stuff a week, and then people are like, oh, yeah? And I'm like, no, literally a ton.
So if you are processing 2,000 pounds of product a week, then you must be selling something close to that.
No, because you lose.
Oh, you lose so much weight.
We lose a good amount of weight in salami and things like that, but we also do roasts, we do fresh sausages, we do bacon that only takes us about 5 days to turn around. I mean, we're smoking bacon twice a week. If you come to the shop and buy bacon, it was probably smoked like 3 days ago at the most. Mm-hmm. So I mean, we do really small batches and we turn it around fast. But what we're doing to address the fact that we've reached critical mass is we're going to start, you know, kind of collaborating with some other really high-quality producers that do have a USDA certification that can get our stuff out to the rest of the country. You know, we get, I mean, I hate saying no. We get calls from L.A. and New York. We just not only are not certified, but we don't have the capacity to do that kind of shipping. I mean, that's pretty much the only thing we've been able to come up with in terms of, you know, making the facility that we have pay for itself. You know, we've got a storefront, and it's getting busier and busier every day. We did our first sausage making class yesterday,
which was
a blast. Yeah, I mean, we're just doing lots of different things. We do pig roasts. We do, you know, we've got one of those old hand crank Burkell slicers that we bring to wineries and people's homes and things, and you know, hand crank salumi. It's so I mean, we're not pretty much we're just not waiting. We're not sitting here twiddling our thumbs saying, oh, we need to be busier. We're really, you know, you got to be proactive.
How does that economy, we have to wrap up in a couple of minutes. Unfortunately,
sure.
We're going to have you back, Taylor, because there's so
100%.
Much to talk about. But just in terms of the economies of scale that that are implied by growing at this exponential rate, like, will you ever be able to bring your prices down because you can support more farmers or more people like Patrick? Or is it always going to be, because it's an artisanally produced sort of handmade product, is that always going to, you know, cost the extra premium price that it does now?
Hopefully, I mean, if we got it to a certain scale, hopefully we would be able to bring some of our prices down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about it is, it's not just the cost of goods. I mean, all of these things to make are
very labor-intensive.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I mean, we're...
People don't get cheaper.
Exactly, and it's
nor
it's
do
the same
pigs.
Thing about it's yeah. the same thing about, you know, paying farmers a fair wage. It's
sure.
You know, labor, you know, labor deserves to be, you know, compensated fairly. So,
and Taylor just took a trip to visit many of the farms that he supports with me.
And
what a blast.
Oh my God, I want to go on that trip next time.
We called it the pig junket. It was a blast.
You had
Cruz
Bailey.
And Dan from Lupa and Otto, and another buddy of mine from Berkeley runs this barbecue shop called T-Rex.
Oh, fantastic.
And my sous chef and I all went out, and we tripped around for a couple days and did as much as possible in 2 days. But, yeah, I want to get back out there soon. It was great.
Well, actually, Taylor, you are obviously going to be back numerous times here on the station.
Yeah, we could do a month of
cover,
programming on this.
Just
really.
On you.
So
whenever's good for y'all, let me know. Thanks for having me on.
Thank
all
you
right.
very
well,
much
thanks,
for joining
Taylor.
Us today.
All right,
take care,
talk to you soon.
Have
okay.
a good one. Bye-bye.
Well, what an amazing main course. We're going to take a break and come back with the Q Report, which stands for Quotidian Culture, but yet another great show. What are we doing next week, Katie?
I don't think we've decided yet, but we could do gardens because we have a fabulous connection to the Seed Savers Garden at the Bronx Botanical Garden, which has just opened up 250 acres of property to community gardening and informing the public about how to garden. So that's one possibility, and we could get Michael Hurwitz in from the Green Market, maybe, and there's some other really great community garden types out
exciting.
There, or maybe we'll get our fish people together.
I like we wait to the last minute.
Yeah, I try to work on a few of these at once. They don't always cooperate. What can I tell you?
And Katie, by the way, thanks. Your special man in your life is now going to be doing his own show on HRN.
I know, thank
which is
you.
Very
That's very exciting. Art burning down the house.
Burning
all about architecture and design. Yeah.
Very cool. So we will be back in a minute. And thanks to all our guests. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you very much for coming on, you guys.